This episode of Women Amplified, Bold Leadership in a New World of Work featuring Malcolm Gladwell, is proudly sponsored by Cisco. Cisco knows that women in the workplace have been disproportionately affected by this pandemic. So supporting and developing women leaders to meet the demands of the new world of work right now is critical. Learn more at cisco.com/careers.
And when we sat down and tried to figure out, when we had three employees, whatever, what our principles, company principles were, make cool things. And the second one was have fun. There has to be joy in what we do. And if you're not having fun, it's pointless. Like, go work in a coal mine. If there's plenty of joyless jobs in the world. If we can't provide joy to our employees, we're failures. My worry about this pandemic phase is that idea of the importance of joy got forgotten. I do not think you can have joy making one Zoom call after another from your bedroom. There's just no joy in that, ultimately. Maybe for 2 months. It doesn't work as a long-term strategy for having fun. Like I said, if we're not having fun, we're failures in this business. That's the part of this that I hope comes back really fast when we all, that everyone reorients and says, are we enjoying ourselves? And if we're not, let's figure out a way to get that back into the workplace.
That was New York Times bestselling author and renowned journalist, Malcolm Gladwell. Hi, I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Before we dive into this episode, I want to remind you about an exciting new opportunity for you to be a guest on Women Amplified. It's our new segment called That's a Good Question. Here's how it works. Tell us about a problem you're experiencing at work or in life, and if selected, you'll have the chance to work with me as a guest on an episode of Women Amplified. And together, we will problem solve. Real people, action-based problem solving, expert advice. It is super easy. Just fill out a submission form online at conferencesforwomen.org/podcast, and our producer will be in touch if you're selected. Okay, now I am so excited about today's episode with our guest, Malcolm Gladwell. We covered a lot of ground, and there's no doubt you will walk away inspired and actually armed with tools to help you lead boldly and meet the demands of the new world of work. So let's get into it. It's a brand new day. Gotta take it on my way. Gotta take it on my way. I wonder, Malcolm, what kind of communication problems were you seeing in teams before the pandemic hit?
Oh, you mean for all of the thousands of years that people have been doing teams?
Sure, if you can give that sure. to me, a 40-second answer, I'll take it.
Well, I mean, the obvious ones, that there is a tension in teams between the efficiency of a team and the diversity of a team. So the more the team looks like me and thinks like me, the easier it is for us to get along, but the worse the outcome, right? What's the point of having four Malcolms who all think the same thing? To the extent that I make my team full of all kinds of different voices and our outcome will be better because we're representing more interests, more experiences, more perspectives, it's also going to make the coordination and communication and social life of the team not worse, but just more complicated. That is the time-honored trade-off in teams. And as human beings, when we get lazy, we default to making the team as functional, as smoothly functioning as possible, which means filling it with people who resemble us. And I sort of feel like that has been the norm for centuries. Why were institutions run by white guys for millennia? For a number of reasons, but the biggest reason was because that was the easiest way to run the world, right? It's super easy.
To varying degrees of success.
Yes. I'm not going to say it was successful. I don't think it was a success. I think there are more failures than successes. But I will say, you know, the British, and you want to run an empire in the 18th century, you just fill it up with other aristocratic, rich white guys. It's easy peasy, right? It's all guys you know. You went to school with them. If you're running a Wall Street firm in 1920, it's what you do. It's like...
Don't spoil the ending, how that turned out. So then when the pandemic hit, mm-hmm. what got worse And I wonder if anything got better.
Well, there's two things going on. One is that in the years leading up to the pandemic, many institutions are finally addressing this problem and saying, you know what, the easy way out, the way of smooth running, conflict-free teams is not the right approach. We have to go the harder route to get a better outcome and make our teams diverse and interesting and complex. And then the pandemic hits, and I think that the difficulties associated with diverse teams get even more difficult. On the one hand, you know, people have been talking about how, oh, we've been so productive in the age of Zoom and blah, blah, blah. But there's an awful lot of tensions that emerge when you're not in the same space. And if this pandemic were to go on for 5 years, I would really worry that we would just revert back to look-alike teams that are smoothly functioning.
Wow, you think it's, I mean, that makes it sound as though you're saying the challenges of changing the way we do business, of changing our workflows, that that's such a high bar that the stress of the pandemic would make us simply stay with what's comfortable.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I could be wrong. It's just my perspective. And that's the perspective of someone. I work in teams and I'm part of a startup that we're trying to build a company in the middle of all of this. And I think it would have been so much easier over the last year if we were all in one space again. Just because so much of what makes teamwork pleasurable as well as functional are those day-to-day interactions. It's fun to hang out with people. And that kind of fun that comes from those intimate, not intimate, maybe is the wrong word, but relatively intimate interactions is what makes the difficulties of diversity a lot easier to cope with. But when you're all in a million different places and you can't see people and you can't judge tone of voice and you're on some scratchy Zoom call, and it's just like, it just gets hard. So I, for one, will be very, very happy when this is over.
Since you mentioned Zoom, I think the fact that Zoom is tiring and exhausting is something I assume most people sort of understand and accept at this point. But I wonder what you make of the data showing that we're having more meetings and longer meetings now. What do you think is driving this urge to hold meetings and go on at length during these meetings while we're remote?
Well, because we've made getting together so seemingly frictionless, right? It's like, right, it's now just a simple matter. Before, at least, if the expectation was the meeting was going to be in person, we had to go to some effort to synchronize schedules and make sure people were physically there. And we were mindful of where people needed to be so the meeting didn't go on and on and on. Now it's like, if I'm working with you every day, I know that you have to go and pick up your kids from the babysitter at 5:15. So if I'm talking to you at 5:05, I'm like, oh, I got 10 minutes to finish this conversation with Lindsay, right? Whereas on Zoom, nobody even, we don't even know anymore. We don't know the context, anyone's context. We just keep blabbing on. Like, there's no longer any kind of useful boundaries, social boundaries to communication. It's just like, it's contextless communication. And it is exhausting and it is omnivorous.
What do you mean omnivorous?
Well, just what you say, these meetings are going on forever.
Oh, yeah. That's eating up all of our time.
Eating up all of our time. Like, I've been trying for the longest time to get an interview with Maxine Waters for this project I'm working on. I met her once. She's just totally extraordinary. So I was like talking to her PR person and I said, well, I'd love to get an interview. Oh, yes, Maxine would love to talk to you. And I was like, she goes, how long do you need? And I was like, I know this is a lot, but I'd love 2 hours. And the person just started laughing. Like, this is no, and she's like, you could maybe get half an hour best. I was like, half an hour? And she's like, and then the person, it was he, well, it's just the pandemic. Like, you understand, like, she has twice as many meetings than before. Everyone knows they can get on her calendar now. She doesn't have any time anymore. Like, if I tried a year ago, I would have been able to get 2 hours. But now, everyone and his mother is like, calling up Maxine Waters and like asking for an interview. So I'm out of luck. That's what I'm talking about.
So I wonder how this affects whatever advice or guidance you give to leaders. Because the challenge of watching over your team members' well-being and their capacity to continue working or whether or not they're close to burnout. I feel like that's changed.
Yeah.
And yet I don't think that management styles have changed in order to adapt to it. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we have ways of effectively managing people that have evolved over years and years and years of working in physical proximity. And then all of a sudden, we go through a year where you can't do that anymore. And years too short a period for us to evolve these time-tested methods of management. So we have a bit of a mismatch. And then there was a giddy period, I feel like, where everyone was convinced this was a better way to do things. And you couldn't read a newspaper without seeing like 7 stories about how we're never going to go back to the old way. The office is dead. Real estate in Manhattan is in panic. And I just read those and I was like, really? You really think that's true? That people want to be working in their bedroom forever? Like, this doesn't strike me as the idea that you would get up in the morning. I remember my first job, first real job, was at the Washington Post when I was 23 years old. The joy with which I got up every morning because I got to go to the office, because the office was just so amazing. I mean, it was like, I was 23 years old and wanted to be a journalist. And it was an office full of 300 people who were amazing journalists. Why wouldn't I want to go into the office every day? It was like amazing. It was like, I would sit there and just listen. You know, Bob Woodward sat 2 rows over from me. I just watch him. It's like a masterclass right there, right in front of me, right? The greatest journalist of my generation was 10 feet away making phone calls. And I was 23 years old and had no idea what I was doing. Like, it was amazing. Like, what? Today, the idea of having that same job and I would be in my pajamas in my bedroom and I couldn't see anyone else and learn from anyone else, it's nuts. Like, of course I want to go back to the office if I'm 23. I want to go back to the office. I'm in the office right now. I'm 57. I'm not working at home right now.
So how do we, I mean, are there then lessons to take from the pandemic? I assume that it won't be long before we're beginning to transition to something else, which may not be A, pre-pandemic habits, and may not be B, pandemic habits, but might be C, a melange of the both.
Yeah.
And I wonder, what lessons do you think we can take away from both the things that worked well and especially the things that haven't worked?
Yeah. I was just doing an interview before I talked to you with this really wonderful author, and he had written this book, which I had loved. And he talks about a very famous, it's all about this very famous police chief in the 50s. And at one point I asked this guy, I was like, well, did this police chief, was there any joy in his work? And the guy I was talking to, who had written a book about this chief, he was like, it's clear that no one had asked that question of him before. And he hadn't thought about it. And he was like, you know what? There was no joy. And that explains a huge amount of how this police chief went horribly wrong in the way he did his job. And that question of whether there is joy in your work has always been one that's been central to me. To me, that's the point of work. And when we sat down and tried to figure out, when we had 3 employees, whatever, what our principles, company principles were, make cool things. And the second one was have fun. There has to be joy in what we do. And if you're not having fun, it's pointless. Like, go work in a coal mine. There's plenty of joyless jobs in the world. If we can't provide joy to our employees, we're failures. My worry about this pandemic phase is that idea of the importance of joy got forgotten. I do not think you can have joy making one Zoom call after another from your bedroom. There's just no joy in that, ultimately. Maybe for 2 months. It doesn't work as a long-term strategy for having fun. Like I said, if we're not having fun, we're failures in this business. That's the part of this that I hope comes back really fast when we all, that everyone reorients and says, are we enjoying ourselves? And if we're not, let's figure out a way to get that back into the workplace.
I've been fascinated by the struggles to maintain engagement as we work remotely and how so many of them have fallen flat. One of the primary ways some managers have used to engage employees is through making Zoom fun or scheduling social events or like trivia nights on Zoom. And it hasn't gone very well.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of tells us something about, say, global companies or people where their employees and their team members are not headquartered in the same place. I mean, you're talking about working at NPR or at a newsroom. And I work at NPR. I know that when you're working in a newsroom, you can have colleagues all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what we've learned about engagement. Have we learned anything new about how to keep people engaged when they're not in the same place?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I have done for the last 20 years a lot of speaking at conferences, industry conferences of one sort or the other. And when I began 20 years ago in giving those kinds of talks, I will admit I was slightly cynical about them. I was like, it's a bit of a scam. People all go to Phoenix in March, play a lot of golf, and then they come in and I'm just there to entertain them, and then they go off and do their whole thing. And then over the years, I've come to have more and more respect for what the purpose of something like that is. It has multiple purposes, but one of it is the thing you were just talking about, which is engagement, which is what a conference does is it takes you for a moment out of your very specific world and throws you into an environment with lots of other like-minded people who are in different contexts and face different challenges. It's a really efficient and fun way of recharging your batteries. It's like you can be a math teacher in a inner city school somewhere and you're exhausted and you're unsure about whether you're making a difference. And then I take you out and I put you in a conference of math teachers and there's 1,000 people in the room and you're going to have 20 conversations over 3 days with other people and realize everyone's got the same struggles as you do and they have all kinds of interesting ways of resolving those struggles and you can learn from them and they can learn from you and you realize you're suddenly a part of a community and you go home after 3 days and your job seems a lot different. And that process is repeated hundreds of times over the course of a normal business year, because there are hundreds, thousands of times, because there's tons of these conferences. And they also function, you know, typically people in the workforce work really, really hard. They have families. They go home, they don't get a lot of, they don't get a break of any kind. And you can give them a functional break at a conference where they can talk about their work, which they love, but in a setting that makes it feel like it's fun. And then they can go and play a round of golf or go swimming or hang up at a pool, whatever. And like that kind of stuff, we've really missed that. I mean, that stuff went to zero, right? Over the last year. It will come back and it'll make a big difference on this question of engagement because it will help people find a way to recharge their batteries. I think of conferences as being a huge part of what it takes to maintain productivity in the workplace.
It's interesting you say that because I was just interviewing a CEO who said she can't imagine spending the same amount of money anymore to send people to conferences. Her rationale was, now that we know we can do it virtually, why would I pay for travel and hotels?
Oh, such a mistake.
Why?
I mean, have fun keeping that employee after 4 years of that, right? You're asking someone to commit their energy, their imagination, their everything to your job. And you're now going to make them, and you had an institution, an annual institution that was set up that allowed them to interact with, socially interact with other people in the same space, in a nice environment, and get a new perspective on their work. And now you're going to say, no, actually, I want you to sit in front of your computer even more instead. Like, it's nuts. It's like the point of work is not to maximize productivity in the short run. And the point of work is not to extract every last dime you can out of your employees. Like, when did that ever work? Show me when that strategy ever worked in the long run. Never, ever, ever.
And yet, that idea of sort of squeezing every last minute out has kind of influenced management styles for a long time. And it's sort of how we've all become addicted to productivity, right? This idea of having people answering emails even when they're on vacation or not taking vacation. I myself have been in a workplace where you have a manager say, don't even think, we're really busy. Don't even think about taking vacations right now unless somebody died. So that really has been a strategy. I mean, we were already heading toward a burnout epidemic worldwide before the pandemic hit. What do you make of the state we're in now?
It's nuts. I remember when my mom went back into the workforce in her 40s, got a job, and said, went to her boss and said, I know you want me to work 5 days a week, but I'm not going to work 5 days a week. I'm going to work 3.5 days a week. And I promise you, I can do more in 3.5 than everyone else can do 5. And her point was not that she was Superman, although she is kind of Superman. Her point was, look, like, if I'm happy and well-rested and can do all the stuff I want to do on the side, I'm just going to be more productive. You don't need me to drag out my work over 5 days. I'm fine with doing 3.5. And she was right. I just think we're underestimating the value of rest. You know, I'm a runner, and the first thing that they tell you as a runner is that you don't rest because you run. You run because you rest. In other words, you get better in the rest period between runs. Like, that's what allows you to improve, is the fact that you consolidate your training gains by doing nothing, by getting away and letting your body come back stronger. And, you know, runners understand this, but I don't know why, if runners understand, you know, we're not the brainiest, most sophisticated people in the world, but we all grasp this fact. Like, take a day off. Like, you have to. I don't understand why bosses somehow think that's anathema.
Yeah, I've never understood that either. But we are in this situation where people are burning out. We know the data shows us that people are actually working longer hours when they're working from home than they did when they went into the office. And we have on top of that a lot of exterior stressors that are adding to people's anxiety. We have not just the pandemic, but politics have not been particularly restful right now. There have been financial issues. And I imagine there's a lot of employees or a lot of leaders who are looking at their team members and worried about their well-being. How would you suggest managers and supervisors support well-being among team members right now?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to answer the question exactly as you posed it. This has been a very useful exercise for us to think about what our priorities are as a country. So, to my mind, the biggest issue in the last presidential election was this thing that you're just talking about, that we just have, for the last 9 months, we have put many groups in society, but particularly parents, middle to lower income parents of school-age children, we have essentially asked them to do the impossible, because we decided for a combination of reasons, some good, some bad, I would say more bad than good, that we were just going to arbitrarily shut the schools and not give parents any other option. So in addition to keeping your life together in the middle of a pandemic, many people with a great deal of workplace anxiety, that was redoubled in the course of the pandemic. We're also going to make the logistics of your life 100-fold more complicated and stressful because your kids are going to be at home. And like, the idea that that wasn't the single most important problem facing the country in the fall of 2020 baffles me. You know, and that's a problem. If I was a CEO of a major corporation, I would have stood up and I would have said, no, wait a minute. Like, we have to have a conversation about this right now, because you are taking the most precious resource in this country, which is the workers of this country, and you're putting many of them through living hell. And the function of government is to relieve those kinds of burdens. That's what government is. That's why we have it, right? And if government's not going to relieve those burdens, then I'm not really sure why we bother. And I didn't see that conversation. I saw a lot of jurisdictions behave in ways that were fundamentally irrational. I saw places that were more willing to open restaurants than schools. Nuts.
You're listening to a conversation with renowned journalist and best-selling author, Malcolm Gladwell. If you are loving this conversation and you want more inspiration, you're in luck. Registration is now open for all of our virtual fall conferences in Texas, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. To find out who's speaking and get your ticket, visit conferencesforwomen.org. And before we return to Malcolm, I want to remind you about an exciting new opportunity in which you can be a guest on Women Amplified. It's our new segment, That's a Good Question. Here's how it works. You tell us about a problem you're experiencing at work or in life, and then you'll get the chance to work with me. You'll be a guest on an episode of Women Amplified, and together, we will problem solve. Real people, action-based problem solving, expert advice.
It is so easy to do. All you have to do is go to conferencesforwomen.org/podcast and fill out a submission form. And then if you're selected, our producer will be in touch. Now, let's get back to the conversation. It's interesting that the conversation has turned this way, because I did want to ask you about sort of the disproportionate effects of COVID-19 and the economic crisis that we're in right now, because you're talking about schools, and we know, looking at just the employment numbers, that the crisis with childcare has fallen more on women than on men.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the COVID-19 pandemic has affected people of color in larger numbers than white people. And so the inequities that we were already discussing pre-2020, the pandemic has simply exacerbated them, mm-hmm. in some ways, disastrously.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how leaders can respond to this. Is there both an ethical and also effective way to respond to this?
Yeah. First of all, I'm thinking of someone who's part of our company who is a mother of young children, and who I just know her life logistically has been insanely complicated over the last 8 months. And every time I get an email from her, I look at the time the email was sent. I think the timestamps tell you absolutely everything you need to know about her life right now. That's when the time she has to do her work, it's like the wee hours of the morning, or got one today at 6:33 a.m. And I know she didn't go to bed at 9 p.m., right? Leaders, have to be, obviously, and I think we're trying to be as sensitive as we can to those kinds of predicaments. But I want to go back to the point I was making earlier, that there is a limit to what leaders of individual companies can do about those kinds of problems. These are social problems that our government has to address. And like I said before, that's what government is for. We have gotten distracted by a series of debates that have nothing to do with the day-to-day lives of most Americans.
Can you give me an example of the distractions?
Sure. Like, if you just analyze the political rhetoric of both sides, and you see how much of it was addressed to these kinds of very day-to-day prosaic concerns of working Americans, it's very little, right? Or you look at the way that we did finally have a conversation. We had an initial round of stimulus funding, and now we have a second round of money that's intended to help out. But how sloppily that money is targeted, right? It seems like we've just gotten one of those leaf blowers, and we're just blowing dollar bills over the country without pausing to say, the effects of this pandemic on people's lives are wildly disproportionate. There are as many people who have said this has been the best year of my life who have said this has been the hardest year of my life. Some people, it's been fantastic, right?
Yeah.
We should at least be able to discriminate between those two groups when it comes to helping out. Or if you look at the sort of preoccupations of popular culture over the last few months, and I don't need to rehash those kinds of controversies. And there's nothing wrong with those controversies per se, but I don't know why of all times we're doing those. Having those discussions now. Can we at least wait until we've addressed the much more pressing concerns of lots of people in this country? I don't know. It's just like, it's that kind of stuff that there's a little bit too much concern about what people are or are not saying on Twitter, and not enough concern about these kinds of everyday issues in people's lives.
And I think also people are reevaluating a lot of things, not just these kind of inequities and the roots of them. I find there's been a broader discussion about what kind of traits one should look for in a leader. There's been a lot of discussion about how some people may have attained their positions not based purely on merit, right? Not just based purely on their strengths and their talents, but also on preferences and systems that support them over somebody else. And I wonder if you have a new list. Have you, in your mind at least, an idea of what a modern leader needs at their disposal, what their talents should be?
Interesting. I am less and less convinced that there is a single definition, I guess I would say. And particularly the older I get, the more I'm aware of how lots and lots and lots and lots of different leadership styles can work. It just depends on the fit to the organization, or just depends on how well the leader in question articulates their way of doing things. I've always thought, if someone once said to me years ago about schools, you know, there's 100 different educational philosophies. They all work if they're just done honestly, right? So you can have a law and order school, and you could have a super permissive school, and you could actually, both of them can educate kids really well. It just depends whether the people who are enunciating that, articulating that philosophy, do it in good faith, honestly, and competently. Like, and I sort of see the logic of that. It's like, I'm more and more, it's not about what you're doing, it's how you're doing it. And maybe that would be my answer to, that's my way of getting to more diverse leadership, is let's not get so hung up on defining what we want in a leader, but more hung up on how someone is choosing to make sense of that leadership philosophy.
So that leads us to talking about your new book. I think it leads us there.
Mm-hmm.
But the new book, Bomber Mafia, seems to sort of grapple with some of these issues of morality and how we make decisions and what we do with leadership when it's sort of thrust upon us, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did you get to this story about World War II and a Dutch genius typing away on the computer?
Yeah. Well, I was, it's funny. It's a, you would think that every story from World War II would have been told by now. Turns out, no, there's still some ones out there. And I just became fascinated by this little group of pilots in central Alabama in the 1930s who had a dream about how to reinvent war. And, you know, they were all people who had been through the experience of the First World War and seen the kind of extraordinarily senseless carnage of that conflict. And they were like, we can't do that again. You know, there must be a better way to, for us to use violence to settle human conflict. And they came up with this kind of dream about, if we can just drop bombs with perfect accuracy, we won't need armies on the ground anymore. We won't need to destroy entire cities. We can just take out a handful of select targets and our enemy will give up and sue for peace. And, but I was, the dream turns out to be not a, yeah, it doesn't work. Yeah. But I love that they tried. And I think that's what attracted to me, is this idea that they're a group of people who articulate a better way to do some complicated task, and turns out to be premature. I mean, we finally enact their vision, but just 70 years later, not when they were dreaming it, two generations later. But the idea that somebody, there's this cast of characters, and I focus on this one guy named Haywood Hansel, who is this deeply romantic, his favorite book is Don Quixote, because he's the knight who tilts at windmills. I mean, he's just this guy who has this fanciful, romantic, utterly impractical vision about how he's going to change warfare. But it ends with him leaving the Air Force in disgrace. But I think he's a hero because somebody had to stand up and say, there's a better way to do this. And someone had to be the one to fail so that others could succeed down the line. And it's those people, you know, we celebrate as heroes the ones who finally make it work. But I wanted to celebrate as a hero the guy who tried it and failed and allowed others down the line to figure out how it worked. That struck me as being really important. In other words, to tell the full life cycle of a moral innovation, starting with when it didn't work.
It's interesting to me, and the reason I connect it with this discussion of leadership is that what you have done in this book is sort of point to the value of failure. And not only that, but hold up as strong people who can embrace the failures of the past, or at least admit to the failures of the past, and be willing to fail again.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a relatively modern value. I mean, we in the past have lionized leaders who were decisive and who wouldn't admit to error because that would be showing weakness.
Yeah, yeah. I will admit that a lot of this is my own kind of romantic attachment to the people who tilt at windmills. I'm very fond of them. But yeah, like that notion of, can we build into our understanding of leaders some expectation about their frailty and a willingness to stay with them through failure? That's like, strikes me as a really interesting notion. Some professions do very much embrace that model, and other professions are quite hostile to failure. And I find myself more and more drawn to the professions that are tolerated, that understand the how important failure is in the kind of evolution of our practice. I'm a huge basketball fan, and professional sports is really interesting because they are super tolerant of failure. You know, if you're an NBA head coach and you get fired, you'll almost certainly get another job.
Yep.
You got to screw up like badly,
ethically,
three or four times in a row before they'll get rid of you. I used to think that was a bad thing. Now I really like it. It's just about second chances. It's like they'll roll the dice. And I feel like if you have a world that's willing to rehire a failure, ultimately, I feel better about the chances of that same world rehiring someone who looks different or who's utterly unconventional. Maybe that's naive of me, but I think we will get a female head coach in the NBA real soon. Like, there is a woman who now, I think she's with the San Antonio Spurs, who people are now talking as a potential head coaching candidate. If that happens to her, as it looks like it might, that is a product of forgiving culture. It's like a culture that says, we don't really know what a successful NBA coach looks like, so we might as well give people second chances and also hire people who don't look like traditional NBA coaches.
I think you're talking about Becky Hammond, who took over when Greg Popovich was thrown out of the game.
Yeah, Becky Hammond. You know, maybe Becky Hammond opens the floodgates. The kind of 24-year-old guy who's in the NBA today, he doesn't care whether his coach is male or female, right?
Yeah.
That generation doesn't have a hang up about that. I worry more about the owner of the team. Players will play to someone who knows basketball and treats them with respect. Like, you know, we've already solved that particular problem. So yeah, I'm optimistic about that kind of culture.
Have you changed anything about the way you work or lead because of the past couple of years?
Well, I wasn't, you know, calling me a leader is a stretch. So I started this company 2.5 years ago with my best friend, Jacob. He does all the leading. I just make stuff. The difference is that for the bulk of my career, I was a writer who worked alone. And now I do audiobooks and podcasts and I work with a team. So for the first time, I have had people actively helping me. And I've discovered I really like working in a team. But I didn't know what teams were like before because I was never part of one. Now I'm part of one and I think it's kind of fantastic. And I've figured out how much you can benefit from, I mean, it sounds ridiculous that at my advanced age, I should be saying this, but I did discover at my advanced age that you're just a lot better when you are surrounded by people who have different skills than you and different experiences and different ways of thinking about things. There's a story I always tell. I've told it many times now. My producer for Revisionist History, the first producer we ever hired, who's now the editorial director of our entire company, when we were interviewing her for the first time, I read her all of the stories I was thinking of doing in the first season of Revisionist History. And she looked at me and she's like, if you do all those stories, no woman will ever listen to Revisionist History. And I was like, oh, I really need to hire this woman because I was not aware of this fact. I was like, oh no, God, what am I doing? She needs to. So we hired her on the spot. Like, you need to come and fix this problem. But like, hadn't occurred to me to that point how narrow my story ideas were. Because it's just me. It's just things rattling around Malcolm's head. Malcolm's one guy with very, very particular tastes. And in that moment, when I was interviewing Mia, her name is, I was like, I discovered, oh, yeah, really, really helps to have have someone who's not, doesn't have your head in the room, right?
Which brings us back to where we started this conversation, which was sort of the value of diverse teams.
Yeah, there's just no question how much more powerful, how much better the... Like I had this discussion, you know, in my book, my last book, Talking to Strangers, I had that whole chapter on the Jerry Sandusky case at Penn State.
Right.
And I was of the opinion that I don't think the leadership at Penn State deserved to have been fired or put in jail. I think they made mistakes that we would all have made in their in their shoes. I don't think they were complicit in the crimes of Jerry Sandusky. That said, had they had a more diverse leadership team, I wonder whether they would have acted differently. In other words, like, it's probably not a good idea if you are running a 21st century university to have a leadership team that is all white guys who are your age. I think that's part of why they got in trouble. And I'm not saying that they needed to have, I'm not even using traditional definitions of diversity here, but having a mother on the leadership team, having someone who had been through problems of sexual assault or sexual harassment in the past as part of the leadership team, having someone who had been through a similar kind of scandal at a previous school. I mean, just having someone who had a set of experiences outside the set of experiences represented by the leadership team of Penn State, that would have been super useful. And that may have allowed them to resolve that problem in a way that was, that did not land them all in jail. So, I mean, there's a way to kind of say, to hold those two things simultaneously. I don't think those guys at Penn State did anything wrong. At the same time, I think there was something deficient in the way their leadership team was structured. And that should be a lesson to lots of other leadership teams, that there's a value in having a wide range of perspectives at the top, because it will really help you when a really thorny, difficult problem comes along, right? And that's what they faced, a really thorny, difficult problem, right? A one in a million case of a seriously bad apple in their midst that nobody was anticipating or had any experience with. So yeah, I'm very happy that Joe Biden has as his co-president someone who's a lot different than he is, right?
Yeah.
I'm quite happy with a 78-year-old white guy as my president, but I'm not happy with two 78-year-old white guys in the White House. Like, that's a problem. I'm glad there's a little bit of...
Understood.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'd be even happier if they reversed roles. That Biden strikes me as he's a great vice president. I think Kamala, ultimately, I think I'd rather have her in the top chair, but let's just wait 4 years for that.
Always an interesting conversation, Malcolm. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. That was really fun.
We hope you enjoyed today's conversation with best-selling author and renowned journalist, Malcolm Gladwell. His most recent book was released in late April, The Bomber Mafia. It's available for purchase at the Women Amplified online bookstore with free shipping. Find a link to our bookstore and show notes and a lot more as well at conferencesforwomen.org/podcast. And if you enjoy this podcast, please tell a friend. We could all benefit from good advice and expert guidance right about now and really anytime. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 55,000 women and men to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and California. Registration for our virtual fall events is now open, so visit conferencesforwomen.org to learn more. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thanks so much for listening. Be kind and be well.